97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Brian Recker filling in for Mark Reardon the next couple of days. Looking forward to spending some time with you. I really am. We've got a big show. Josh Hammer's joining us in about 15 minutes or so from now. Newsweek senior editor at large, host of the Josh Hammer Show. You can hear that Saturdays, 1 o'clock here on the station with the Democratic lawmakers that have met with potentially the next mayor of New York. And what's going on with Mamdani in this meeting? Are they trying to distance themselves from the socialist side and they're trying to make him into a socialist version of Donald Trump, which is, we're going to stick away from some of these social issues that are unpopular and I'm going to stick with how unhappy people are. And that's what I'm going to try to hone in on. That would be interesting. And I know Ethan was looking for this clip. I got to tell you, I was listening to the Fox News update at the top of the hour. Did Donald Trump call the head of the Fed, Jerome Powell, a knucklehead? I have to hear that in its full context. I just heard Fox News play that little bit, and it caught me so off guard. I had to laugh, so I need to hear.
Who has plans, or if you're back considering firing Jerome Powell, and what's your justification if you're thinking about this to do this?
He's always been too late, hence his nickname, Too Late. He should have cut interest rates a long time ago. I don't rule out anything, but I think it's highly unlikely. Unless he has to leave for fraud.
Graham, have you drafted a letter?
No, I haven't drafted a letter.
So you didn't show a letter to Republican lawmakers last night?
No, I talked about the concept of firing him. I said, what do you think? Almost every one of them said I should. But I'm more conservative than they are.
Okay. Did he say it there? I must have missed it at the end.
I didn't hear him say that, but he did. No. He did throw some sort of, I think, passive insult, mix some sort of passive insult in there,
right?
Earlier in it,
I swear I heard him at the top of the hours call him a knucklehead. We have to find that clip. I have to hear that in its full context. Well, one of the other big things, the president officially signing the Halt Fentanyl Act, which permanently classifying fentanyl related substances as a Schedule I drug, which is necessary. We have such a huge issue when it comes to illegal drugs and fentanyl and what's going on. This is what I think is good about it, Donald Trump. You have him that is going to go hard on the people that are pushing these drugs on people. Knowing or not, if they are a drug dealer and they give a deadly drug to someone and they end up killing themselves over it, you should be held to the fullest extent of the law, even if you possess fentanyl. The idea that you got it from someone, go ahead, tell the police who you got it from. Let them be the ones to get in trouble, because we got to stop this stuff from hitting the streets. And there's so many people that are ruining their lives, families getting ruined over this stuff. It's not a viable strategy for Democrats to say the only thing you need to do is arm yourself with some of this nasal spray, this Narcan, Naloxone, or whatever it's called. Just keep the nasal spray at arm's length. So if you see someone overdosing, just give them a little touch in the nose and it'll bring them back from the dead. That's their solution to this. We're not going to go after the dealers hard. What we're going to do is treat the people that are getting abused by these dealers that are putting all this fentanyl into the systems of all these drug addicts. It's terrible. And in some cases, even the drug companies are the ones getting busted for this, these opioid epidemic. And that's why you see a lot of these drug companies paying out massive settlements to states, because they have to undo the amount of harm that they put on people. So we need to take care of that, too. A couple of things I want to get to, because I know we're going to talk more about the New York City race for mayor there and Mamdani meeting in the next segment, which I think is going to be a good one. I wanted to talk a little, two things. Well, I saw this one thing. Do I want to do this now? No, let's do this real quick.
Hey, before that, we found the knucklehead clip, I think.
Oh, I got to hear it. Can you play it?
Yeah, give me. Here we go.
Okay.
President Trump says it's highly unlikely he fires Fed Chairman Jerome Powell before his term ends next year.
He's a knucklehead.
Ethan, can you isolate just that clip and we can play that in random spots during the show today?
I'm sure we can make that happen.
Oh, what a fantastic Donald Trump audio drop. That is an all-time classic. You can put that on the button bar wall of every talk radio station in the country because they will be using that one. He's a knucklehead till the end of time. It's just too good. Too good. Thank you for finding that. All right, two things. And I saw this one survey came out. 77% say they would not consider joining Elon Musk's third party. Most American voters say they would not consider joining an Elon Musk-founded third party, according to the poll. Earlier this month, he said that he's going to form the America Party. It's a third political faction that goes against Democrats and Republicans. A big part of that is government spending and waste. Now, there was a story on that, too. And it's not enough to satisfy Elon Musk, and I think it's not enough to satisfy me, but still, it's a step in the right direction as the Senate is poised to hand a $9 billion spending cut package to Donald Trump to sign, the second big legislative victory, they say, as they continue to try to drop what was supposed to be $9.4 billion, but it's now about $9 billion from the Office of Management and Budget. They have that rescission package ready to get the votes in the Senate, which is good. So some of the things that they had to bend on is they're not going to be dropping votes for, or excuse me, they're going to amend to remove cuts to the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief in the global initiative that was started by George W. Bush. And they're also going to redirect some money to some public broadcasting entities in South Dakota. As far as Elon Musk is concerned, he's 100% right. We are overspending and we need to find ways to spend less. In fact, we need to go in the opposite direction and we need to cut out the things that we shouldn't be spending money on to begin with. And he would know best. He spent all that time with his staff going through all the different ways that we are abusing our spending powers and giving recommendations on how we can drop some of that. And I don't know how many more further rescission packages there's going to be, but keep them rolling. $9 billion should just be the start, the baby step in the right direction. Another thing I saw is that RFK Jr. perhaps is gearing up for a run for the White House. This one was just reported not long ago. His super PAC, the Robert F. Kennedy Jr. super PAC, calling on supporters and influencers, stirring speculation that Kennedy's positioning for a run at the White House in 2028. This one kind of took me by surprise because when I thought about the different Republican members that may want to run for their party's nomination in the next election, normally you think, oh, J.D. Vance, you know, he's going to be up there. That's going to be a big one. Marco Rubio, possibly. You kind of run down the list and like, who could possibly be there? I got to tell you, I should have thought about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He was just out of sight, out of mind for me. I thought maybe he's content making America healthy again, but maybe not. So that'll be an interesting thing, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more during the course of the show today, too. Two things I want to talk about. One other thing at the start of the show, because there's so much going on. And Representative Jason Smith here from Missouri was talking about the cuts to NPR funding, which I think a lot of people are in support of, myself included. Can we play clip number 13 where he discusses this?
We have been raising this red flag in Congress for a long time, and Congress has not acted. Sometimes you got to shake up things in order to get some accomplishments and wins on the board, and that's in fact what we're going to do here.
Yeah, and got to cut NPR funding. So biased, some of the things that he was saying there, and I got to say this too about NPR funding. And I think about this as a broadcaster, and this is one of the angles I really don't hear all that often, but it's one of the main reasons why I think it would be necessary for it to happen. I think about myself as a broadcaster and the different radio stations I've worked for. We're a commercial radio station, and we do the best we can with the resources that are available to us. And in our industry in radio, we've seen so many different people get fired. I'm myself one of them. I've been fired. And you think about it, and you're like, man, there's all these good people that lost their jobs because commercial radio is not in a good spot right now. It's very difficult to continue to get the same revenue or more or keep up with the pace when people are cutting back. And all of a sudden, your competitor, if it's an NPR station, is getting money from the government. And you find out, like I was shocked to learn the NPR station in St. Louis, and I can't remember what it's called, but they would have like an hour daily news show, and they would have like 5-6 people working on the show producer-wise. And I'm thinking to myself, you got to be kidding me. If you're accepting money NPR or PBS, and you're putting on 1 hour shows at a time, highly produced, and you got five or six producers working on a 1 hour show, you're telling me that you can't afford to do what every other commercial radio station in the history of commercial radio has done, which is scale back to your means. And then if you want to be able to justify spending more, you go and do it the way you've always done it. You ask for support from the community. And if they believe in you the way you think they believe in you, then you should be able to get that money to justify these large staffs and these giant salaries that they pay them. It is way over the top. And why should they have that advantage when all everyone else in commercial radio around them, who is still competing with them, have to continue to fire people to keep up? Why should they get government money and be able to continue with this path? I think it's ridiculous. It's an unfair advantage that they have. In fact, it should be leveled. So I think we're going to find ourselves discussing this over the course, too, of the show. I'm Ryan Recker, filling in if you want to find me online at Ryan Recker. Josh Hammer's joining us, Newsweek senior editor-at-large, host of the Josh Hammer Show, which you hear weekends here on 97.1. I want to talk to him about this meeting that Mamdani had with Democratic lawmakers in New York. I also want to talk about the Epstein files with him. Coming up after the break, don't go anywhere, 97.1 FM Talk. I'm Ryan Recker, filling in for Mark Reardon. Oh boy, joining us now is Newsweek senior editor-at-large, also host of the Josh Hammer Show. You hear it weekends here on 97.1 FM Talk. Josh Hammer, hello, sir.
Hey, it's great to be with you. I appreciate it as always.
I have to say that Fox News at the top of the hour gave us perhaps one of the best Donald Trump clips I've heard in a long time. I don't know if you heard it, but I'd like to play it for you. As someone in radio, I think you'll truly appreciate this Donald Trump drop.
He's a knucklehead.
Perfect, isn't it? That's all you need. Donald Trump calling someone a knucklehead is all you need for a talk show anymore.
Look, he's known for this. He's definitely known for these wonderful nicknames. That is pretty much undeniable at this point, I would say.
Oh yeah, but it's almost like a gift that keeps on giving. It seems like anytime there's a press conference, you can pull something new from it. That's like old school Trump back in the first term. He used to give that. You don't get as many this time around. So I wanted to talk to you about this meeting of Mamdani in New York, and it sounds like Democratic lawmakers who are meeting with him are trying to find ways to support him, meaning they want to give him conditional support, so they're trying to find ways for him to back down a little bit on his super socialist views in order to make it work based on their worldview. Is that what it sounds like?
Look, the Democrats in New York City are somewhat between a rock and a hard place, right? Especially the old guard. I saw Jerry Nadler, who is considered to be the dean, the elder statesman of the New York City congressional contingent. He was quick out of the gate to throw his full weight and support for Zohra Mamdani before we knew really anything whatsoever about the state of the Andrew Cuomo and or Eric Adams races, but This has been the song and dance that I think a lot of Democrats who are still even kind of sort of maybe somewhat sane have been trying to pull off for a very long time now. And this has been going on for at least a decade. I think back actually to the Iran nuclear deal and Chuck Schumer, another one of these New York Democrats. Chuck Schumer was under a lot of pressure. You know, Chuck Schumer, he used to go campaign in very Jewish parts of New York City, Brooklyn, which is where he's from and so forth there. And he would try to tell his constituents that he was running to be what in Hebrew we would say the shomer, which is the guardian of Israel. And he was trying to say this was actually his name, Schumer. I'm not sure that's true, honestly. It might just be a German name. But anyway, he was under a lot of pressure to oppose Barack Obama's nuclear deal, is the point I'm making. And he did so at the very last second when he knew darn well that it was too late to make a difference. So this is kind of the song and dance that a lot of these so-called centrist moderate Democrats have been doing for a long time now, but it's become somewhat of an unstoppable, inexorable force because the natural direction of the Democratic Party is just trending in such an aggressively left-wing direction. I don't see this ship turning around anytime soon. And frankly, as a conservative who wishes the Democratic Party nothing but pain and punishment, I'm not necessarily overly upset about that, I suppose.
Well, let me read this line from Politico. It says, as Democrats search for a winning message and campaign strategy heading into the 2026 midterms, some in the party have pointed to Mamdani's campaign and its social media variety or virility, rather, as evidence they need to focus more on cost of living issues rather than hot button culture war issues. So focusing on cost of living issues, it sounds like they may start learn some of the mistakes from this past election, and they're going to try to remedy that through a socialist, which kind of is laughable.
Look, I mean, calling this guy a socialist, Mamdani, is, if anything, overly generous, right? I mean, this is a guy who, if you go to his social media history, if you do an advanced search on X, Twitter, whatever we're calling it these days, you will find him literally citing the Communist Manifesto. I mean, he actually has quotes of Karl Marx, some of his most infamous lines, for every man according to his abilities, according to his needs. He's a communist. He is an actual student, disciple, acolyte of communism. And you kind of throw that in with his very, very pro-Islam, pro-Muslim stance, while simultaneously being deeply anti-Israel, probably outright anti-Semitic. I'm sure he's no great fan of Christianity either, to put it clearly. When you combine these things of his communism with his stance on the religious issue, I think what you see is a single person who encapsulates what many of us have referred to over the years as this red-green alliance, this alliance between the Marxists, the communists, and the Islamists, who really have nothing in common whatsoever other than a mutual desire to overthrow Western civilization and the biblical origins of Western civilization. So he's kind of a one-man wrecking ball in that respect, the best encapsulation of that red-green alliance that we've seen in America, at least since Linda Sarsour was the leader of the Women's March back in 2017, give or take. And he's a total atrocity. As someone who grew up in the New York area, most of my relatives still live there. I can tell you firsthand, everyone is terrified of the possibility that he might win. But unfortunately, if I had to guess, I think he's probably going to win, to be honest with you.
Wow. Okay. Let's move on for the sake of time. But the Epstein file story, is it going to end with denying there's a list, or do you think this is going to further down the line and perhaps we're going to see something that resembles a list in the future?
I think that this story is going to die sooner rather than later. I have been saying this basically since day one. I frankly can't believe that we're still talking about it, right? And that everyone's still talking about it, for that matter, a week and a half after the DOJ and FBI put out that announcement. Now, I'm not defending the administration's handling of this necessarily. There have been obvious, very serious errors that have been made. Quite simply, trying to reconcile Pam Bondi's statements on Fox News back in February with what the DOJ just put out, it's a very, very difficult circle to square. And I think that people are rightfully upset. On the other hand, you ask the median Trump voter, I mean, what did you vote on? And it just beggars belief that most people would say transparency for the Epstein files. I mean, last I checked, most voters for Donald Trump, most conservatives, Republicans, and so forth there, care first and foremost about the issues, about inflation, about the economy, jobs, crime, immigration, stability on the global stage, and so forth there. So I think that this is going to move on sooner rather than later, and I'm somewhat bamboozled that we're still here. I guess I'll end with this and say that there's one thing I know about President Trump's base, is that they are extraordinarily loyal to President Trump. And if he truly, truly digs in his heels and say that we have to move on, which certainly seems like the move that he's pulling off right now, the people will fall in line sooner rather than later.
Okay. If people wanted to look you up online, where can they go?
I'm on X, Josh_Hammer. Instagram is Josh B. Hammer. And then my own show, which can be heard right here on Saturday afternoons, actually, is the Josh Hammer Show as well.
Fantastic. Great work on the Josh Hammer Show and everything else that you do. I guess there's always something to talk about. So I'm sure you got a big show planned for this weekend. Good talking to you here in St. Louis.
You too. Always a pleasure.
I'm Ryan Recker, filling in for Mark Reardon. If you want to find me online, at Ryan Recker. Joining us after the break is Daniel Turner, CEO of Power the Future. So when President Trump comes out and says, hey, Pittsburgh, guess what? We're going to be investing billions of dollars for AI and energy in Pennsylvania. That's a pretty big deal. So what exactly are they going to be spending this money on? So we're going to talk to him about that, what the future may look like when it comes to power and AI. Coming up after the break, I'm Ryan Recker, filling in 97.1 FM Talk.
We raised 92, it's actually going over 100, so it'll be over $100 billion to be invested in Pennsylvania. It was Pennsylvania Energy Project. So we had, everybody was there. Larry Fink was there. I mean, everybody was there. And done a great job. The senator did a great job.
All right. The president is announcing $100 billion plus that'll come from private sector investments into Pennsylvania, saying that AI will be leading as an industrial powerhouse to compete with China. But we need to put the money into it first. Joining us now is Daniel Turner, CEO of Power of the Future. Hello, Daniel. How are you?
Hey, Ryan. Great to be on with you. Thank you.
So $100 billion, where does that put the United States versus China, let's say, who has unlimited resources that they steal from the people in order to try to, I guess, steal intellectual property from the United States, too? So where does that put the United States versus a country like China?
Well, if you're in the AI world, you would much rather operate in America because you don't want your intellectual property stolen, right? You don't want all of your data, your information. This is sensitive stuff, these codes, all of this AI infrastructure. So they would prefer not to operate in China. But at the end of the day, you have to go where there's reliable, dependable, affordable energy. And so a lot of countries are going to make overtures to try to win them because, look, you can build a database anywhere, right? I think probably the most attractive place to put these data centers for AI is in Alaska because you don't need to commute, right? You don't have to worry about weather. You don't have to worry about snow stopping you. Once they're operational, they don't really need a staff, so they shouldn't necessarily be in metropolitan hotspots, but they are going to go where they can get reliable, affordable energy. So kudos to Pennsylvania for making huge overtures to try to bring them to their state.
Yeah, and it worked. And so part of the larger, grander strategy of the United States is to be leaders in artificial intelligence. And what would that even look like? What does the United States have to gain from leading the world in AI?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we're at the very beginning of the AI revolution, the way those of us who are of a certain age may remember the late 80s into the early 90s when we were beginning the tech revolution and the internet, right? There's that famous video of Katie Couric saying, "What is the internet?" Right? People didn't know what it was. And that almost seems laughable at this point. It is laughable, right? We joke about it. But that's where we are in AI, and I think the industry itself knows what it can do. Really, all AI is tremendous amount of computing power, but condensed down to nanoseconds. So when you look at something as complicated as, hey, let's map the human genome and see if we can find where cancer resides, you can do that with 1,000 scientists poring over hundreds of thousands of pages of documents. It's going to cost you a lot of money, and it's going to cost you a lot of time. Or you can write the code and have AI do that in a fraction of time and money. And if you are able to do that, look at the advances you're able to make in medicine, in cancer research. I want America to lead that charge, right? I don't want China to lead that charge. Of course, there are scary implications for AI. It's not all rainbows and sunshines, and it can be used for nefarious purposes. But whatever it is used for, I think we would be better off as a world if those origins have their foundation here in America and not in a rogue communist regime like China.
Yep. CEO of Power of the Future, Daniel Turner, joining us. So when I think Pennsylvania, I think coal. I think coal. But it seems like these big tech companies that are trying to lead their own AI revolution, they're moving to nuclear. They're finding like abandoned sites. They're going to bring them back to life and power it themselves as opposed to trying to bring power off the grid. So what does powering AI look like? Is it just building smaller nuclear facilities for it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's lots of that. It's definitely reliable nuclear. It's reliable coal. It's reliable natural gas. It's reliable baseload. And, you know, it is not surprising that when Microsoft announced they were opening up Reactor 2 at Three Mile Island, they chose nuclear power for Microsoft's AI. They did not choose to build a wind farm or a solar farm. They wanted reliable, cheap nuclear. So it's kind of interesting. Like, tech companies, they want wind and solar for the rest of us. But when it comes to their profits, they want what works. And that's why they're choosing Pennsylvania, because it has coal, it has natural gas, and it has potential for more nuclear as well.
And you know what? I think that point needs to be said again. When you have these certain industries that are pushing incentives onto people to try to get them to solar, to get them to wind, things like that, and they took advantage of some very generous government grants and opportunities to do so, even after all of that, it seems like it wasn't enough to power massive amount of people that would be necessary for it to be sustainable, let alone in even one company's worth of consumption when it comes to the technological advances that are necessary. There is some hypocrisy there, and I think it's probably a good thing that we're cutting down some of these different incentives for things that have, you know, not actually paid off in the long run. Or do you think that maybe some of these incentives need to continue for the clean energy?
Oh God, no, 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 no. Let these companies would, these companies would, will do best if they are forced to compete in the free market. No one incentivized the oil and gas industry. No one subsidizes the coal industry. In fact, these industries create and put tax revenue back into the economy. And people will say, well, they get tax rebates. They can write off. But any business can do tax write-offs on capital expenditures, right? That's not the same as a subsidy. Wind and solar only exist because the government requires it by law and the government pays for it to exist. And I'm not a Keynesian. It feels like a lot of Republicans suddenly became one as they're defending these tax credits, saying, well, if we close the wind and solar tax credits, you know, companies may shut down. Well, the government's job is not to keep companies afloat. The government's job is not to pick winners and losers. Now, I called my company Power the Future because I don't know what the future looks like, but I do know our present is a heavily dependent fossil fuel present. And if we punish ourselves now, we are not going to have a brighter future. So let's let those geniuses who want to perfect wind and solar or geothermal or thorium or blue hydrogen or all these things, let's let them figure it out. But let's us continue to rely on what works, and what works right now are fossil fuels.
Yeah, and I think, you know, credit where credit's due to Elon Musk. He found a way to make it production-wise to the masses, and everything works in line with each other. So we brought the cost down, which made it a very popular option for a lot of people to buy his electric cars. But you haven't seen the same thing with his solar company side. He thought he'd be able to do the same thing with it. It hasn't really taken off. And I got to tell you that once in a while you talk to people that have installed these sort of things, it takes so long for it to pay off. I don't know what other revolutions are out there waiting to power the future, but I got to tell you, it's definitely lagging behind even after the billions and trillions of dollars we've already spent on it. Doesn't give me a lot of optimism.
No, and you wonder what would have happened if that money was spent elsewhere, right? What if that money was spent or just not spent at all? I mean, that's the problem with the government. You don't have to always spend money. The government doesn't seem to learn that lesson, but you're absolutely right. You know, I have a working sheep farm in rural Virginia in addition to Power the Future, and we looked at getting solar just out of pure curiosity. We looked at the rebates. We looked at what it would do for the farm. The out-of-pocket costs were so astronomical, it took 30 years to pay them off, but solar panels only live about 12 to 18 years. And so I thought to myself, this is deeply immoral that the government is encouraging people to take out a 30-year financing on a product that they know will live at best 20 years. You know, people should go to jail for such a predatory lending, as we used to call it. But when you do it in the name of climate change, you're allowed to violate natural law. You're allowed to violate ethics. You're allowed to do whatever. And I think that that's barbaric.
Yeah, we got to be honest with this, too, and going on it, maybe not even on a farm side. But we're running into people, and you find this when they go to sell a home and they're locked into one of these long-term contracts. They try to tie it into the sale of the home, saying that the new owner has to assume the obligations of that loan. People don't want to pick up someone else's solar panels and have to pay an extra $20,000 for a house. It ain't happening. So these people are having major regrets down the line if they decide to sell the home. Or let's say it's not operating the way that they were promised it would operate because these salesmen oversell these things. There's major disappointment that people have that put these in. And we're finding that story a lot more common.
Is going to look like we may get to the point that residential solar is this wonderful solution, but it's not necessarily there now, and giving people free taxpayer dollars to pretend it's there is not a solution either. And I, you know, we know that getting rid of these subsidies is going to make some American companies suffer. Some Americans are going to lose their job. That was the threat for the One Big Beautiful Bill, saying if we get rid of these subsidies, people who work in these industries will be out of a job. That's tragic. You know, but what's really tragic is that we gave them these jobs on Keynesian principles to begin with. And this is what happens when government starts getting involved and tinkering outside of their purview.
Yeah, and I mean, we have to actually have some tough love conversations sometimes. So if you look at some of these contracts, that the Biden administration signed in when it came to the electric car grid and spending billions of dollars for like nothing, them studying the infrastructure and building nothing, helping no one when it comes to electric vehicles. There's people that are making money off of this stuff, but there is absolutely no benefit to the consumer or the people that they're promising to help. So some of these jobs that are going to be lost were just opportunists that were taking advantage of the government's generosity. So again, we have to be realistic when we talk about some of these positions that may be eliminated. They may not have been helping people to begin with.
No, and actually there's a wonderful story today on in the New York Post that I just put on my social account of Biden's promise to bring thousands of electric mail trucks, and they signed a multi-billion dollar contract, and we were supposed to have thousands of them delivered by now, and we have 93 of them. But what we don't have is the $1.7 billion that was awarded in the contract that has disappeared. Someone got very rich. Someone bought a beach house. Someone bought a boat. But what we didn't get is electric mail trucks. And again, this is the nonsense that we do in the name of climate change, where there is grift and theft and outright fraud. And until people start going to jail for it, it's never going to stop.
Yeah. So if people wanted to look you up, Power of the Future, where can they go?
PowerTheFuture.com. Look us up or give me a yell at Daniel at PowerTheFuture.com.
Very easy. PowerTheFuture.com. Daniel Turner. I know this is going to be a topic a lot of people are paying attention to, but in the end, what's your level of confidence this $100 billion investment in Pennsylvania is going to pay off on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being most likely it'll pay off quickly, 1 being it's going to take a long time or not pay off at all? What's your level of confidence?
6.5. And the only reason why that would seem a little bit low is because it still has a Democrat governor, and there's still a lot of opportunities to put up red tape and to kind of throw wrench in the works, right? But the interest is there, and the leadership is there. It's a matter of people getting out of the way and letting it happen.
You know, I know that there is going to be red tape, and there'll be people getting in the way of it, but on the counterpoint, you know he's just going to ask for more money, so he's going to probably milk this for even more private investments. So in the end, money talks, and I think that could be the beneficiary there. Daniel Turner, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ryan. Thank you.
And I'm Ryan Recker, filling in for Mark Reardon. Don't go anywhere. 97.1 FM Talk. You know, producer Ethan, I don't know this song. Is this another musical selection out of your deep cuts?
No, so we actually made a change recently. We are all music beds now.
Oh, okay. Is that for the streaming purposes? So you stop getting kicked off of YouTube?
I'm sure that's one of them. I think they were just looking to mix things up. Also,
okay, cool. Well, thank you for all your help today. I'm going to show this to the camera. Anyone that may be streaming, look at all these audio cuts that you guys pulled today. You guys are so good at doing that.
Fred actually for pulling all those cuts, and then. James is our associate producer today. He is the one that put them all, numbered them all, yeah. And put them all down on the paper. So not far more than just me doing stuff over here. Appreciate all the help.
Fred is so good. You know, if it was me, I'd just say, thank you. You're welcome.
It's the reason he's a Hall of Famer.
It's my wife always criticizes me for taking the credit of things we do together or she does all together. So we'll be somewhere and they'll say, oh, you guys did such a great job with this. And it'll be like 100% my wife did it. And I'll say, oh, thank you very much. That's very nice.
It's the group project, right? When you get credit for it and you get a good grade, but you did nothing.
Yep. And I look at her, I give her that look. I'm like, I know. I didn't do anything. I'm getting the credit. Sue, I don't know if you listened at the top of the hour, but there was probably an A-plus Donald Trump soundbite that dropped during the Fox News. I don't know if you heard it, Sue, but can I play it? You heard it.
Oh, yeah. He's a knucklehead.
What a great audio drop. In the world of radio, I don't know if it gets much better than that.
He's a knucklehead.
Oh, gosh. You're right. It's great.
Yeah. Jerome Powell, I think he was referring to. But I haven't heard the full clip yet. I want to hear it in context. Not that it'll change anything. But I want to hear it in context. You know, I was at the start of the hour, too, talking about NPR and the funding that goes into NPR. And we should probably play the counterpoint to that. Lisa Murkowski wants to keep funding to NPR, at least some of it. This is clip number 21, if we can play that, Ethan.
If you don't like what's going on within NPR, you think that there's too much bias there, we can address that. We can address that, but you don't need to gut the entire Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The entity the program that provides for so much support, particularly for those in rural places.
I totally disagree. I feel like you can absolutely gut NPR. And I'll go back to the point I made before. We work in an industry, in radio in particular, that has cut, and so many good people have lost their jobs on the commercial side. And I remember talking to someone over on the NPR side that, even in St. Louis, they have like an hour talk show a day, and they got like seven producers working on it full time. They're probably making 80 grand each or something like that. I don't know. I'm just throwing these numbers out. I don't know for sure. And then that on top of that is you have the executive producer and then the program director and all these other things. For a 1 hour show, they have all these people working it. And I thought to myself, you're getting government money. On the commercial side, I see a lot of good people lose their jobs and their livelihood. And the government is providing you to overcompensate and overspend when it comes to your staffing for something that you're providing a fraction of the service these commercial services, commercial radio stations provide. I would argue that you listen to all of this NPR national programming that is very left-leaning and liberal-leaning, that they're piping in through a satellite, and there's very little local content that's being produced, that you're not doing a service to these small rural areas just by saying that you're picking up satellite programming from a national perspective for something. I think that if you really wanted to justify these, you're going to have to put them in the same category of what these private entities, these commercial radio stations are facing, and let them compete just like everyone else. And if they find that the donor base wants to continue to contribute to them, they'll find more money from private entities to continue to fund it as a nonprofit, just like anyone else. You don't need the government intervention here. And that's not even addressing the liberal bias that is attached to their programming to begin with. So I got to say, go ahead and gut NPR, keep it going. And I know it's a lot of them say that it's just a small percentage, 5% or whatever of what their budget is. Then go ahead and find another way to make it up, just like every other company has to. I wanted to play this too. I think we played the Jason Smith clip when it came to the NPR. You want to play some more Donald Trump clips? This is from a little bit earlier. I wanted to play clip number 31 because this goes back to something we discussed regarding Epstein. And I was a little bit surprised by Josh Hammer, who is taking the stance that of all the things that we need to worry about in this country, the Epstein client list is so far down the list that we are over amplifying its importance versus how important it really is. I got to tell you, I don't believe that whatsoever. I think that when you have a government conspiracy and you know the person was a prolific trafficker, a sex trafficker, preyed on children, and he had high profile clients, it is not unheard of to think that when you have those type of clients, there is a way you can make a list of the people that you supplied these children to as a sex trafficker. And the fact that they will not put something together for us to see what they based their evidence on is ridiculous. So it may not be something that is going to impact inflation, which is going to be a much bigger problem down the line. It's not going to address our national debt. But to say that don't worry about it is totally tone deaf and totally against what the people voted for. They wanted this transparency. Let's see. This was clip number 31 from Donald Trump, if we can play that.
Some lunatic around the desk had a policy. Whoever operated the auto pen had a policy, which is, by the way, I think the biggest scandal. That's the scandal they should be talking about, not Jeffrey Epstein. The scandal you should be talking about is the auto pen, because I think it's the biggest scandal, one of them in American history.
Yeah, that could absolutely be true. No, that's true. What I don't like is the stance that don't worry about it. It doesn't exist. You know, do you remember, Ethan, the Dave Chappelle classic stand-up he did on Saturday Night Live? This is during the first Trump presidency. Do you remember him talking about how a star was born when it came to Donald Trump? Do you remember that one?
I don't think I do off the top of my head.
Fantastic. And the backstory is great because he was hosting SNL, controversial. Dave Chappelle, one of the best comedians of all time. And oh, do you remember that, Sue?
I'm just happy to always hear Dave Chappelle, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, he goes in there, and the funny thing is they do a dress rehearsal. He does his stand-up that's completely different because he knows if he performs what he really wanted to perform, they wouldn't let him do that stand-up as part of the monologue. So Dave Chappelle goes in there and talks about Donald Trump when he was debating Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton going on and talking about how all of your rich friends, Donald Trump, this and that. And essentially, I'm going to be fast-forwarding this. You have to go back and watch it for yourself. But Donald Trump said, that is not true. He's like, you know what? The reason why you're against this is because all these people that gave you money are also taking advantage of the same tax breaks that I take advantage of. And you won't cut it because you know you'd lose all of your donor base. And so Dave Chappelle brings it up as a matter of fact. Here's what's really going on. You're lying to people to say you're going after rich people because you know it's going to be hurting the people that support you the most. And Donald Trump said, I know because I take advantage of it because it's the law and you had your chance to change it. You didn't. So we know what side you're on. And Dave Chappelle goes and lays it all out and it makes so much sense. And he says, that's when I knew a star was born because I was watching it and I said, no, what he said is right, not what Hillary Clinton was saying was right. Hmm. I think the moment we're having right now is when we're watching this on the stage and you're pointing at it and Donald Trump is up there saying, there's no list. Don't worry about it. Don't look at the man behind the curtain. We're saying, no, he's not right. The other people are right here. They're having that wake-up moment a lot of people had on Hillary Clinton is the way Dave Chappelle described it. Now they're having that moment on Donald Trump right now, and that should really scare him because now he's on the wrong side of this conspiracy, that it's not so much a conspiracy when you think that if there were clients, then there's a list. If you're saying there's no list, then you're trying to say there's no clients, which we totally do not believe. It's worth revisiting that. I would say maybe do some homework tonight, Ethan. I know I've listened a little bit of the Andy Fry show. You're not one to do homework, but I would say you probably should still do it. And Sue, for your own entertainment, if you want to go back and listen to that monologue, it's one of the best Saturday Night Live monologues of all time. It's the only time I would ever endorse watching a Saturday Night Live clip on YouTube.
Hear that.
All right, coming up after the break, we're going to talk a little bit more, but of course, Sue's News is one of my favorite segments. We're going to get to that coming up on 97.1 FM Talk.
Get more at 97.1talk.com.